It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. Coming up later on Central Time, we'll learn by why one elections official is concerned that the ongoing John Doe investigation and a ruling in that investigation could open the door to future campaign finance wrongdoings.
But first, much has been said and written about the recent Great Recession, usually accompanied by finger-pointing to the role of reckless lenders, banks, and the government's subsequent response.
While the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009 can be traced to a lot of factors, our guest today says to get to the root of the problem, we need to look a little closer to home, to the role of household debt.
Could the real reason for the economic collapse be that millions of Americans just took on way too much debt? And if so, would we have been better served if the government bailed out debtors instead of creditors like big banks?
Amir Sufi joins us now. He's professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's co-director of the Initiative on Global Markets and co-author of the new book, House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Can Prevent It from Happening Again. Amir, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you tackle a big problem, not just what caused this recession, but trying to get to the root of what causes recessions in general. It's a bit tall order.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you look at, for example, U.S. history, you see right away two times in the last, you know, century where household debt jumped tremendously. In the late 1920s, prior to the Great Depression, and right before the Great Recession. So our two most severe economic downturns were both preceded by a big run-up in household debt burdens.
Well, one thought is that recessions are part of the natural flow of things. Things get going well for a while, and then they cool off and go sour, and that's just part of the capitalist system, and we have to live with it. You don't buy that.
No, we don't. I mean, I think, I think there is obviously going to be some economic fluctuations that naturally occur. But these kinds of big depressions where millions of people lose their jobs, we don't think they're something that's inherent within the economic system. We think they could potentially be avoided if we think more seriously about what our financial system is doing to foster so much household debt. And we look across countries and you see the same pattern, that countries that took on the most debt before the Great Recession are exactly where you see the recession's most severe. So we think there's something man-made here, as we put in the book. It's not just some inevitable result of economic growth.
Let's dig into 2008 and start a little before then. There are two big steps you see. I want to take them one at a time. The first one, this big climb in household debt. How big was that growth and why did it happen?
Right. So, for example, we show in the book that one of a main measure we use to measure household debt burdens is the total amount of debt relative to personal income. So that just gives you a sense of how much debt we're taking on relative to how much we're earning every year. And we saw that increase from 2000 to 2007 by more than it had increased, you know, in any period prior to going back again to the Great Depression, just an unprecedented rise in household debt. That was obviously closely related to the housing boom. And what was going on is that people were really aggressively borrowing out of their home equity, borrowing and then spending that money. So in some sense, we were seeing a big boom in economic activity that was artificial in a way. It wasn't based on fundamental improvements in income or wages. It was just borrowing against money that in some sense wasn't there, because ultimately when house prices crashed, it proved that that money was just ephemeral. It wasn't anything that was based on real economic growth.
And a big part of the picture is who was borrowing. And there's a lot of growth in, as became famous afterward, the subprime lending. Who was entering the debt realm and why were they particularly vulnerable to a decline in housing prices?
Right. So we've known for some time in research settings that there is a segment of the U.S. population that borrows very aggressively if they're able to get credit. It's been shown in auto loans, in credit card loans. We call these borrowers in our book marginal borrowers. What we mean by that is they're on the margin of being able to borrow. And usually lenders don't lend to them, to be frank, especially on mortgage lending. But something fundamental changed from 2000 to 2007. all of a sudden lenders seem to be willing to lend to borrowers that previously were not able to get mortgage credit. And as a result, a lot of these borrowers, which had very low net worth, so they were not did not have a lot of money before they took on the down payment and the mortgage, they basically became very highly leveraged because as their house price went up, they borrowed against that equity. So the only thing they had basically was about 20% equity in their home. And that made them very vulnerable in terms of what would happen if house prices crashed.
You make an interesting comparison in the book. Let's take a homeowner. There are a lot of things beyond their control that can damage the value of their house. A tornado or a fire can destroy a house.
Right.
A declining housing values can take away from the value of their house. If you have insurance for a tornado, you get paid. You get some of the money back. You're at a house. You're at some physical risk, but you get something. You say that mortgage debt, in effect, is like anti-insurance. Why?
Right. So just think about how a mortgage works. And let me give a very simple example. Suppose you buy a $100,000 house and you put in $20,000 of cash, so you have $20,000 of equity in the home, and you take on an $80,000 mortgage. If house prices fall by 20% so that your home now is only worth $80,000, you have lost all of your equity in the home. That is, the way mortgage debt works is that you as the homeowner, as the equity holder in your home, you bear the losses of a decline in home value before the bank that holds your mortgage experiences any loss. So it's in some sense the exact opposite of the way insurance works. So take the tornado example. If a tornado, hurts your home or destroys your home, then the financial system pays you in order to compensate you for that loss. So the financial system, is, in some sense, takes the loss, whereas debt works the exact opposite. It actually forces you to take the loss first, and only after you're completely wiped out would the financial system actually bear any of that risk. That's why we kind of call debt the anti-insurance.
You offer a solution for that, and I want to get to that in a little bit. But first, I want to pick up the thread now. We've got this massive growth, you say, in household debt, and there's another step that precedes this recession and, you say, other recessions, a decline in consumer spending. How much did that change before 2008, and how did that lead to the crash and the depression? The recession.
Right. So if we push that analogy further of how debt works as the anti-insurance, what happens then is that people with the fewest means in the economy, the poorest homeowners, they lose out because their home equity is destroyed as house prices crash. And now house prices started to decline quite rapidly, even in 2007, especially in some areas of the country like California and Florida. So what happens at that point is the households that were owning these homes, they massively pull back in spending because, all of a sudden they had only, say, $20,000 in their home, and that's reduced to zero. So you see this very dramatic decline in household spending, particularly on durable goods, things like automobiles, things like washing machines, furniture. And one of the facts we point out in the book is that even before September of 2008 and the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the heart of the banking crisis, even before then, there was already a very dramatic decline in household spending. And so we always say people point to Lehman as the event that triggered the recession. That's actually not accurate. The recession was already going to be very bad even before Lehman Brothers collapsed. You can see it very clearly in the data that cover household spending. So that was really what started the whole vicious cycle that ended up being such a bad economic depression.
And then in the government response to it, you say in effect, we don't have our eye on the ball. Because we're focusing on things like banking collapses, a lot of the public policy response is geared toward helping the banks, which aren't the fundamental cause of the crash and the recession.
Right. So, I think it's always very important to separate cause from effect. And I think the banking crisis was an effect of the housing crisis. That's the reason why Lehman Brothers lost so much money and the banks lost so much money, was precisely because the housing collapse was in some sense bringing down the economy. And one of the things we criticize in terms of the way policymakers responded to the crisis was this very narrow, singular focus on saving banks. And I want to be clear here, we're not advocating that banks should have just been allowed to fail. There was, of course, necessary policy interventions to help stave off financial panic in the fall of 2008. But because the policymakers were so uniquely focused, it was almost like tunnel vision, on the banks, they then did not undertake serious efforts to help underwater homeowners, people who were suffering dramatic losses in wealth. And ultimately, it was their pullback in spending that was really sending the economy into the spiraling downturn. So in that sense, you're exactly right. We kind of think policymakers dropped the ball on that one and should have focused more on efforts to help underwater homeowners.
We're talking with Amir Sufi. He's professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's co-author of the new book, House of Debt. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that we're too prone to taking up too much household debt when we have the opportunity to? Where do you put the blame for the crash of 2008, the Great Recession? Do you have a question for our guest about the story he's telling? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're talking about what caused the recent Great Recession and how to prevent it from happening again. Amir Sufi is with us. He's professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. His new book, he's a co-author, House of Debt. The story so far, rising household debt and then a decline in household spending were a big factor, played a big role in causing the recession. You can join the show at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your thoughts on how to prevent another crash like this. Again, 800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls in just a minute. But Amir, before we do, I want to get to one of your prescriptions about changing the way we do mortgages. What would you like to see change?
Right. So the book is very much forward-looking in that aspect of thinking of revising the financial system in a way that would help improve what we call risk sharing. What we mean by that is the financial system, just like when a tornado hits your house, bears some of that loss. And likewise, we think mortgage contracts and debt contracts in general should be more flexible in the sense that if house prices in your city or your neighborhood collapse, our argument is that the mortgage contract should be set up so that your interest payment and your principal balance on your mortgage should automatically get reduced, be smaller. And you may say, well, of course, a lender is going to charge me too high interest rate then because they're going to be bearing risk. And our idea to help offset that increase is to also provide the lender with some of the capital gain if your house appreciates and you sell it. And what we show in the book is that you wouldn't have to share too much of the upside in order to still get an affordable mortgage. So, for example, we show that you would only have to provide maybe 5% of your net capital gain to a lender in order to induce the lender to be willing to bear some of the downside risk. So ultimately what we're saying is that the financial system should help actually share risk that homeowners bear instead of just imposing all the risk on the homeowner and bearing, you know, and that ultimately is why these severe economic depressions sometimes occur, is because of that uneven risk sharing.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Diane on the line in Stoughton. Diane, hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask your opinion about the role of stagnant wages. It certainly seems that the majority of working class Americans were losing buying power pretty rapidly, and that seems to be a pretty big contributor to that situation. So I'd like your opinion on that. Thank you. And I'll hang up.
Thanks, Diane. Amir?
Yeah, of course. I think that's a very important issue. It's not something that we talk extensively about in the book, but it is something we've been thinking about a lot in our research. Basically, we have to ask ourselves, why are people in the lower half of the income distribution willing to borrow so aggressively? And I think that is closely related to the increase in inequality in wages and wealth that we've seen since basically the 1980s. And so with stagnant wage growth, of course, the only way to kind of keep your consumption up, keep your spending up, is by borrowing. So the effect of inequality on borrowing and aggressive borrowing is a very important issue, something that we've been thinking about a lot in our most recent research. And who knows, that may be the central focus of our next book that we write. But the caller's exactly right that you have to think about the broader phenomenon of income inequality when we think of why people are willing to borrow so much.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Dee with us in Janesville. Dee, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up?
We are currently underwater on our mortgage. We took out a second mortgage just before the value started to decrease to make some improvements and are underwater. We can afford our payments. We're happy to make our payments and pay off the balance that we committed to. What would help us is if we were able to refinance to a lower interest rate. And what I found is this, because we have a second mortgage, we're not able to combine them to get a lower interest rate to help us out with that.
Dee, thanks a lot for the call. There were some programs on here from the federal government to try to help people who were underwater do that, refinance at a lower rate, I believe. Did those go anywhere?
Right. So Dee is exactly right in the sense that this has been one of the major policy failures, I think, of our government in terms of not allowing solvent homeowners, people who have never defaulted on their mortgage, to refinance into lower interest rates. This sometimes could be a cost saving of $500, $600. So, Rob, you're exactly right. The policy was called HARP, the Home Affordability Refinance Program, and it was a dismal failure up until 2012. In 2012, they were able to get to about 2 million homeowners to be able to refinance into lower interest rates. But most people estimated in 2008 and 2009 that there were up to 20 to 30 million homeowners that would be able to refinance into lower interest rates with some facilitation provided by policy. So basically, there are so many homeowners just like Dee who are still underwater on their properties. And remember, I just want to make sure everyone understands, this is not about forgiving debt. This is not about principal forgiveness. It's simply allowing homeowners to refinance their mortgage to get a lower interest rate, given that interest rates are at historic lows. So the programs have not been nearly effective enough, and that's been a major policy mistake in our view.
Dee, thanks for the call, and good luck to you. Jake is on the line now in Milwaukee. Jake, hi.
Yes, hi. I guess I have a little bit of a hindsight question about the 2008 crisis. Now, setting aside the subprime issue, would it maybe have mitigated the issue if they froze payments on mortgage payments to let, you know, the crisis settle down before people started having to pay and obviously, you know, not being able to pay and going through that whole process?
Jake,
yeah, I mean, I think that one of the policies that was instituted, for example, after the Great Depression and after America's first financial panic in 1819 was exactly temporary, what they called debt moratoria, which was just basically having lenders forgive interest payments for a short amount of time in order to let homeowners basically get back up to speed. That would have helped a lot. Another policy that we discuss in the book at length is allowing bankruptcy judges to write down mortgage debt in bankruptcy. Our view is that that would have been a sufficient threat to lenders, that lenders would have been more likely to come to the table and restructure the mortgages. So all of these policies that would have helped ease the burden on households of paying interest and paying principal on mortgages, especially for underwater properties, we believe would have helped lower the kind of burden and therefore helped support consumer spending in 2008 and 2009 when it was so crucial.
Amir, you've looked back at what led up to this recession and other economic downturns. Are we learning lessons here? Are we going to be able to avoid the next big recession or know what to do, how to read the warning signs and make it not as bad as it could be?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think that across the world, there has been an increased appreciation for the dangers of debt-financed asset bubbles. So, for example, the Bank of Israel, the Central Bank of Israel, the Central Bank of South Korea have started, when they see housing bubbles and debt getting too high, they've started to do policies to try to restrict that growth in debt. But I do fear in the United States, even though these arguments, I think, are making their way into the realms of policy, I still think that we're too reliant on debt contracts, and that has a lot of danger to the economy. The example I often give is student debt, which is a major issue right now in the United States with over $1 trillion of student debt outstanding. And even now, people essentially are punished for being born in 1987, 22 years before the worst recession in a century, and they still have to make their payments on debt. Their principal balance is still the same, even though through no fault of their own, they're going to have a hard time finding jobs. It is this way in which debt imposes losses, imposes difficulty on the debtor that we really think needs to be rethought. And that's really one of the major goals we have in this book is to try to get people to think a little bit more carefully about what debt does.
All right, Amir, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Amir Soufi. He's co-author of the new book, House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Can Prevent It from Happening Again.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, tomorrow is the birthday of Earth Day founder Gaylord Nelson, former governor and senator from Wisconsin. We'll look back at his career and his legacy.
But first, a state elections official warns that candidates could have direct control over millions of dollars of undisclosed corporate contributions following one judge's ruling in the John Doe investigation of Governor Walker's recall election campaign.
Kevin Kennedy, the head of the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Board, raised concerns about Judge Gregory Peterson's interpretation of campaign finance law in an affidavit he wrote back in February.
In addition to having financial control over donations, he also warned that political candidates could form secret committees and direct them to run large-scale and negative advertising without disclosing who made the contributions.
We have Jay Heck with us now. He's executive director of Common Cause here in Wisconsin. Jay, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you, Rob. Appreciate it.
It seems like the core issue that Kevin Kennedy was apparently bringing up was this idea of coordination between, if I'm a candidate, my campaign and outside groups. This was like, it seems like there used to be an electric fence between those two organizations in the past. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this revelation of this snippet from a February affidavit is a really good summary of what this investigation, this now 2 years old almost, is all about. And it really is. For a long time in Wisconsin, it has been illegal for candidate campaigns, candidate of, in this case, Governor Walker in 2012 in the recall election, to coordinate or really even be in touch at all with outside groups that may support that campaign, but using their own resources and, you know, running ads that are not part of the Walker campaign in this case, but ads that would be what we call phony issue ads that would be supportive of Walker or detrimental to Walker's opponent, who was Tom Barrett at the time. So, and what Kevin is saying here, and Kevin, by the way, has been overseeing our elections since 1978, so he knows what he's talking about. What he's saying is that under the interpretation, in this case of Judge Peterson, but also by the charges that have been brought by the Wisconsin Club for Growth and others against this investigation, is that if we don't have this firewall, as you called it, and that's actually a good word for it, then anything could go. There could be the candidate could consult with these outside groups. They could spend millions of dollars. The candidate could direct those ads, but appear to stand away from it, and the public would not have any idea what's going on. And that's very dangerous.
So why is that dangerous? I mean, we know that this campaign and their supporter, they're all on the same side. They're working for the same goal, the election of candidate Walker in that case, or whatever candidate we want to name in the future. Why is it bad if they, you know, divvy up the labor a little bit?
Well, here's the problem, and it's and by the way, if this stands, if this policy that allows coordination stands, it would really go further than even the Roberts Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has gone in their incredible opening up of the campaign finance laws in the country and consequently in the state. The problem is corruption. And the deal is that if you have a candidate who's running his own campaign and these outside groups come in, well, the outside groups could be promising all kinds of stuff if, you know, the candidate decides he wants to do something or will do something to favor them. But even more so, the candidate then becomes very beholden to these outside groups for spending, you know, in this case, $9 million. And, you know, it doesn't take a genius to see that the corruption of all of this money could have a very, very deleterious and detrimental effect on the making of public policy in Wisconsin and anywhere else that this is allowed to happen. So this firewall has been in place so that there is no danger, there shouldn't be that danger of that corrupting influence of these outside groups working with a candidate. In 1997, a Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin, who won, by the way, Justice John Wilcox, was fined $60,000 when his campaign engaged in illegal coordination with an outside group. Justice Wilcox didn't even know about it, but nevertheless, that was against the law then. It is now, and it should be in the future.
Well, you mentioned the Roberts Court. They're taking a narrow view of what corruption is. The view would be, if my business hands you a bag of money for your personal use, you, the candidate, or builds you a new summer home in exchange for doing something, that's corruption. If I spend on behalf of your campaign or donate to spend on behalf of your campaign, that's political speech. Yeah, it might look a little shady. Political speech is important. The government shouldn't restrict that.
Well, one of the things that that Eric O'Keefe and the Wisconsin Club for Growth are asserting and some of these other outside groups is that unless you run a communication that says vote for, vote against, support defeat, those are what we call the magic words. If you run a communication like that, then yes, you should have to report your donors, and yes, that could constitute illegal coordination. But most groups don't run those types of communications anyway. Most of them run what we call phony issue ads, which is issue advocacy masquerading as campaign ads masquerading as issue advocacy. Those would be the type of ads that say, John Smith wants to pollute your water and destroy your schools. Call John and tell him not to do that. Well, that has the same effect as vote for or defeat. So that's what we call a loophole. And that's the loophole that these groups are trying to exploit. And they're trying to say that by using this, there's no corrupting influence. And again, the U.S. Supreme Court has gone pretty far, but they haven't gone that far. And indeed, the Roberts Court has even said that we should require in Wisconsin and the nation should require disclosure of these outside groups. So at the very least, the people of this country and of Wisconsin would know who's trying to influence their vote at election time. What this whole investigation seeks to do with the Club for Growth is to destroy disclosure and to destroy any laws governing coordination and corruption. We would have literally the Wild West here in Wisconsin where anything goes and all the money could be spent and no Wisconsinite would know where it comes from or who's giving it to the candidates.
This is just a judge's ruling. Does it really have that much effect, or is this something that could be appealed on and on? Is this almost sidebar in this judge's ruling really going to have that far-reaching an effect?
Well, you know, Rob, there have been so many twists and turns in this entire drama. Just last week, as you may know, Eric O'Keefe and the Wisconsin Club for Growth sued to try to keep the Government Accountability Board out of this. They said that they've overstepped their jurisdiction. There have been, as you say, preliminary decisions made by Judge Rudolph Randa, a very conservative judge in Milwaukee. No, these were all are on appeal. The Randa decision is on appeal before the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. I'm pretty hopeful that that will be overturned. And with regard to whether or not the Government Accountability Board has the right to oversee our elections and to make rulings like this, of course they do. The GAB was set up in 2007, right after the biggest political scandal in Wisconsin's history, the Legislative Caucus scandal, when the State Elections and Ethics Board failed miserably to police wrongdoing in the Capitol, and that five top legislative leaders of both political parties were criminally charged and ousted for office. A bipartisan majority in the legislature set up the GAB in 2007, and they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, which is to investigate things like illegal coordination. So what we're seeing on the part of Club for Growth is an attempt to destroy and go after anybody who is trying to investigate them. I think in the long run, it's going to fail.
You know, with all the Supreme Court rulings lately, limits on aggregate donations by one person to a number of candidates, it seems like the floodgates are open for money. It's going to make it through one way or another. Why is this one issue, this coordination issue and the extensions you've talked about from it, so important?
Well, because coordination does what the Supreme Court and even the Roberts Court has upheld continually is that you can regulate this type of activity if it leads to corruption or, just as importantly, the appearance of corruption. And I don't think it takes a genius to see that if you had these outside groups coordinating with the candidate, there would be plenty of room not only for corruption, but certainly the public would perceive it as total corruption of the system. So that's why I think that the coordination rules are going to stand. I also think that this idea that only those types of communications that use the explicit vote for, vote against, so-called magic words, I don't think that's going to fare well in the long run either, because obviously everybody knows that there are many other types of communications that can call for the defeat or the election of a candidate that don't use those words. So I think on both those important counts, justice, in my view, will prevail, that we will have, or we will continue to have, disclosure. We'll get disclosure, hopefully, in Wisconsin, and that these rules governing coordination between outside groups and candidates will stand. On the other hand, I've been wrong before, and it's very possible that the court could surprise us yet again.
Jay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Jay Heck. He's the executive director of Common Cause in Wisconsin, bringing us up to date on what he sees as possible fallout from just one of the twists and turns of the John Doe investigation. On Earth Day 1970, 20 million Americans displayed their commitment to a clean environment. It was called the largest demonstration in human history at the time. More than a billion people now participate in annual Earth Day activities. The idea of this day set aside to focus on protecting the natural environment was the brainchild of U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. Tomorrow's the birthday of Gaylord Nelson, and today we check in with someone who can tell us about one of Wisconsin's most well-known political figures.
Bill Christofferson is a former journalist and longtime Wisconsin political consultant, now retired. He lives in Milwaukee. He's the author of the book, The Man from Clear Lake, Earth Day founder Senator Gaylord Nelson. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk about Gaylord.
Well, let's talk about some of his politics. You know, on the eve of his birthday, tomorrow is his birthday. Tell us a little bit about where these politics came from.
Well, he grew up in a political household in Clear Lake, Wisconsin, in Polk County, up near the Minnesota border. His parents, his dad was a country doctor, and his mother was a nurse. And they were both progressive followers of Fighting Bob La Follette, the famous reformer, and were deeply involved in progressive politics. And so he grew up surrounded by that, and clearly was shaped by that and became a leading progressive himself.
And he was elected governor age 42 in 1958. So what was his platform for Wisconsin at the time?
Well, it was interesting. He was only the second Democratic governor in Wisconsin in the 20th century. And the first one was kind of an accident. It was during the Roosevelt landslide in the 1930s. So the odds were pretty long against him, and he really didn't expect that he would win. He thought he would run and get known and get his name established and probably run again a second time. But he ran on a platform. He described the Republicans, who had been in control of everything for 20 years, as fat and feeble. It said they had a lot of dead wood. They've been sweeping problems under the rug. The leadership is old and tired. They've got fat and flabby being on the job for 20 years. That kind of thing. Basically, that it was time for a change. That Wisconsin had been a one-party state for too long, and it was really time for a change and to give the Democrats a chance. And the Democrats in Wisconsin had been almost non-existent for a long time. Gaylord and a handful of other people in the late 1940s and 1950s built the party almost from scratch to where it became competitive. And the first breakthrough was in 1957 when Bill Proxmire won a U.S. Senate seat. And then the following year, Gaylord was elected governor in Wisconsin for the first time in decades, truly became a competitive two-party state.
Well, he was only governor for 4 years, and then he moved on to the U.S. Senate, ran there. What made him decide to run after only 4 years?
Well, These days we say only 4 years, especially, I guess, after Tommy Thompson and some others. But in those days, the governor's term was a two-year term, so he had already been elected twice. And his feeling at the time, and it's hard to imagine that now, but that was that he had accomplished most of his agenda in that four-year period, and he had gotten a lot done and wanted to take the opportunity to make a run for the Senate. Again, it was a real underdog campaign against Alexander Wiley, who was the senior Republican in the Senate at the time. His conservation record as governor, one of the main accomplishments of his time as governor was to create a really visionary conservation program that these days we know as the Stewardship Fund. At the time, it was called the Outdoor Recreation Action Program. But it set aside a penny a package tax on cigarettes to raise $50 million to preserve open space and recreational land and wildlife habitat. At the time that no one in the country was doing that, it became kind of a model for other states, and it stamped him as indelibly, gave him a national reputation too as an environmentalist, and or at the time we called him conservationist, and that had a lot to do with his successful run for the Senate too, that people really related to that.
Well, as you say, he was kind of ahead of the curve on conservation and later on environmentalism. Where did that come from?
Well, when you ask him about it, he would say that he became an environmentalist by osmosis growing up in Clear Lake. And he describes his boyhood in Clear Lake, which at the time was a village of about 700 people, really is idyllic. He and his friends spent almost all of their time outdoors. Spent a lot of time either hunting or fishing or in the summertime swimming and camping and hiking. He and his friends were outdoor kids and very interested in nature. And I think his mother had a big influence, too. She also was an environmentalist. He couldn't. When you would ask him, he would say he could never remember a time really that wasn't an issue that he cared about.
And in terms of his contributions to the field of conservation and environmentalism, he is probably best known for being the founder of Earth Day. Where did he come up with that idea?
Well, he had the idea from the time he was elected to the U.S. Senate, even before he took office. His one main agenda item was to try to find a way to get the environment onto the national political agenda and make it part of the debate. And his first idea was to enlist the president, John Kennedy, and he persuaded JFK to do a national tour and talk about conservation issues. And Gaylord thought, if the president says this is important, that's it. It's going to catch on and everybody's going to pay attention. Well, that didn't turn out to be true, and he was disappointed by that. So he went back to the Senate, and this was in 1963. 6 years later, he was in California making a series of speeches about environmental issues. Had just been in Santa Barbara, where he had seen the site of a huge oil spill in the ocean, and was on the plane to his next stop in Berkeley reading a magazine about the teach-ins that were going on at the time on college campuses about the war in Vietnam. And he said that the light came on. He said, why don't we have a teach-in about the environment? And that's how he announced, in September of 1969, he announced in a speech in Seattle that there would be a national environmental teach-in the next spring. And it was a story that made the wire services, but not a big story, but it ran around the country. And his office was inundated with calls and contacts from people who wanted to know how they could be involved, to the extent that his Senate office couldn't handle it. They had to set up a nonprofit organization called the Environmental Teach-In, which eventually by April became Earth Day. But it was only 7 months later that Earth Day happened, and 20 million people, as you said in the introduction here, at the time there was 10% of the people in the country participated in one way or another. So it was beyond his wildest imagination.
And just very briefly, Bill, not long after that, we saw the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. Did he see Earth Day as leading a momentum to get that legislation passed just a couple years later? And I'm sorry, just 30 seconds left or so.
Clearly, Earth Day started what became known as the environmental decade. And in the next 10 years, 28 major pieces of environmental legislation were passed, more than had been passed in the entire history of the country before that. And clearly, Earth Day launched all that.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Gaylord Nelson with us today.
Well, thank you, and happy birthday tomorrow, Gaylord.
That's right. Gaylord Nelson's birthday would be tomorrow, 1916, the year he was born. We've been talking to Bill Christopherson, the author of The Man from Clear Lake, Earth Day founder, Senator Gaylord Nelson.